The writer has to be obsessed with the subject, and the subject has to be obsessed with their subject.
Tell me about that.
I think it really pushes you to find the right stuff. The steps are really like, pick your subject, spend time with this person. The third is just like, yeah, reading and background on them. And then the fourth is just getting the words right to express that thing.
What stands out in terms of what you've learned about writing from your time at Stripe?
Two things. Most not clear writing is about not clear thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second piece is like tapping a tuning fork and seeing what resonates, because then you have an artifact of ideas available to anyone at the company.
What are the downsides of a writing culture like that?
This is actually a kind of a funny story.
Do you ever feel like you're writing something and you just struggle to get your personality onto the page? Definitely something I felt. And when I struggle with that, Bree is one of the people who I like to call up. And if you've never heard of her, it's because she's been behind the scenes at companies like Figma and Stripe. I mean, she basically founded Stripe Press. When I think about her, I don't just think about personality. I think about care. I think about craftsmanship. I think about quality. And that's what this episode is all about. How do you produce great things while also putting your personality into your work, putting you onto the page? So if that is something that interests you, you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Bree Wolfson.
Let's dive into your years at Stripe. You did Stripe Press. You did a lot of internal writing. What stands out in terms of what you've learned about writing from your time at Stripe?
Two things. One is just what a force for clarity writing is. Most not clear writing is about not clear thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sort of flip that on its head, that means that you can get clear in your thinking by getting clear in your writing. So a lot of, I mean, I think this is what you're referring to. I'm like taking notes, like, what are my own thoughts? Like, I want to get them clear. A lot of my writing is about, I'm just trying to clarify my own thinking on this topic. So that at like org scale, very powerful, because you're getting like a lot of clear thinking on stuff. And then the second piece is if we like take the Twitter analogy, it's like tapping a tuning fork and seeing what resonates. That also on the org level is very powerful, because then you have an artifact of ideas and now you don't need to translate them or transfer them through a meeting or a one-on-one conversation. They're actually just available to anyone at the company. This is amazing force for sort of like cohesion and resonance and sort of org-wide understanding. Not so much for core teams. I think core teams do that naturally, or functional groups that stick together. It's more about the people who are like far away on the other side of the org. All of a sudden they get sort of unfettered access to your ideas and your thinking in your corner. And that's a really good cohesive force.
There's like an open email policy.
Open email policy. Actually, I should say, I don't know if this has changed now, but the roots of it, yes. Every email was sort of CC'd into a group that anyone can read.
And how much internal writing were you doing? Like, what was the nature of it?
Yeah, I'd say there's like two kinds of writing. One kind is just like general sort of stuff you're doing to like advance work in your day-to-day work. The more interesting stuff is what I like to call like a curation layer on top of the work.
Huh.
So it's just sort of like a quarterly business review or my thoughts on this or a friction log about this one flow and then publishing that into the org. That's the stuff that's interesting because it's sort of, it's curated for an audience of someone else. And I would say Stripe spends a lot of time on that kind of stuff. Just like reporting on like, what are we doing? What are we thinking? How are we feeling? What's next? So a lot of the like sort of thinking work came out through the writing.
And is that individual, collaborative?
All, both, neither. Lots of different flavors. I think there's like a high, Stripe's writing culture is like very related to its reading culture. Strong stomachs for reading, which means like strong stomachs for writing.
What are the downsides of a writing culture like that?
It's kind of the difference between doing like a research survey when you ask people like, what would you do in this scenario versus just observe them in the scenario? So I think you can kind of like pull yourself out of the work and like look down upon it and like judge it and talk about it. And like sometimes actually just doing it is where your answers are. So I think you sort of get, you can get a weird relationship between thinking and doing. And I would say Stripe was like teetering on maybe like too much thinking sometimes, despite I think externally appearing like we ship very fast. I think internally it felt like there was a lot of contemplation behind the scenes, which maybe is like is an okay balance. And I think that thing probably shifts over time. But I think you can sort of get over-rotated on thinking or pontificating or predicting. You can argue about ideas when actually like, I think Facebook's got a value that's like code answer, like code settles arguments or something, where you can like maybe just settle the argument or like the principle's friction through just doing the thing and seeing. So yeah, I think there's this relationship between doing and thinking.
What's principles friction?
You can imagine you have two different ideas and you need to sort of like resolve the principle in order to get the work off the ground. So I'm trying to think of a a good example of this. Maybe like speed and quality or something is like the classic trade-off where like, should we move faster or should we like rev this to higher quality? And you can sort of like debate which of those values you want to uphold. But maybe it's better just to like get going and see where you land.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And tell me about the origins of Stripe Press. How did that happen?
The origin of Stripe Press. This is actually a kind of a funny story, I think, where John, Stripe's president, had received a manuscript on his desk as a reader, and this was for what became the first Stripe Press book, Elad's High Growth Handbook. John loved it so much. He was like, every single one of our users should have this. Like, we want to empower any entrepreneur to like do a great job on Stripe. We think this will help them do that. Let's like send this to every customer. So I was charged with the task to turn that into a book that we could get to every customer. So that meant like sourcing paper and finding the book printer and coming up with a design language and selling physical products for the first time, which Stripe had never done before. So it's like all this infrastructure just to get one book sent. And I was like, wow, I think by doing this one book, we've sort of built enough infrastructure. We're like 80% of the way there for the next book. Should we just like try a few others? So I think this is like my great idea. And then it turns out, so Tyler Cohen was one of our first four authors. It turns out he and Patrick had been like talking about this Stripe Press idea for a long time. So classic good leadership. They like incept me with an idea. So I think it's mine. But really, they had the strategy in mind all along. But yeah, it turned out we did an experiment with four books and it turned out to be unbelievably effective in ways we couldn't have even imagined. One in particular that stands out to me is just in terms of our talent brand, like how many people at Stripe said that they joined or got excited to join because of the books. And I think what's great about that is true to Stripe's culture. Stripe, like I said, is a reading culture. It's very cerebral. We're very ideas focused. So it was like, great. If you're attracted to this company because you publish books, you're probably a good fit for the culture.
The other thing that stands out is when you open the books, they open flat. So yeah. Both of the
I'm so glad you noticed. Sides. Thanks, David. Lay flat binding. Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about this. I don't have the words, but you sound very passionate about this.
Well, this it's funny. This is like we were just talking before we got recording about reality has a surprising amount of detail or like the things that annoy you. And yeah, this was a thing that annoyed us. Like, why when I like flop something down, it will just like bounce back. So it turns out there's a special kind of binding called lay flat binding, where instead of gluing all the paper to the spine, you can actually you use some threads that has some give. So if you lay it flat and you look at it, well, actually there's like a little rainbow of threads you'll see, and that's like some give in the binding. Versus if you just glue it to the spine, it will like get stuck there, so it'll pull anything back on the edges.
Huh. Yeah. Reality has a surprising amount of detail.
Yeah. So we spent some time getting that piece right, and of course it's more expensive to do it this way.
Well, it's beautiful, right? There's a specific design to Stripe books. The covers tend to be very dramatic. What were the first four? Like, let's see how I do. I think I can do the first five. So first was High Growth Handbook, Stubborn Attachments. Then I want to say it was some combination of Elegant Puzzle, Dream Machine, and Get Together.
Revolt of the Public.
Oh, Martin Gurry. Yes, that one's great.
Yes.
That one's actually my favorite color. And is my favorite cover too.
That brand is very in style now.
That brand is really good. And the colors of the Stripe Press books are very saturated.
Yeah.
But they're like accent colors.
There's a story behind
saturated.
That too.
Tell me. Bring it on.
It's so funny that you're noticing all of this because we pored over these decisions and it's cool that they come out. So the way a book cover works is it's like a piece of cardboard with paper glued over it. And normally that paper stock is like dyed just on the surface level, which means like when you wear the paper a lot, it like wears to white. But we purchase what's it called? An impregnated stock, which means it's actually blue all the way through or gray or whatever the color of the paper is all the way through. So it will never get that white worn. So yeah, this is why like they feel very vibrant is because they never like wear out like that. And the idea was like, we hope people bring this with them to the coffee shop. We hope they bring it with them to work. It's going to be in their backpacks, rummaging around. What's going to happen when the corners get bent or pushed or worn? We're like, no, we want them to still feel very high quality and robust. So this is why we choose this like impregnated stock.
The other thing that stands out about your time at Stripe is not just that you wrote a lot, but that you managed different writing projects. Yeah. What'd you learn about that?
I just love strapping myself to like thinkers. And like tinkerers and doers. And I think one of my superpowers is being sort of like next to creatives or people who have great ideas and sort of pulling out the interesting things. So that makes like a good partner in a writer. So a lot of times it was like, I would help people write their, Stripe has a big culture of shipped emails. Like when you finish a project, you sort of tell the org about it and you sort of give a story about how it came to be and what you've learned. And it's sort of an internal marketing document. So this is like one of my favorite things to help people with at Stripe was just like, okay, like what was the story of doing this great thing? Like what's interesting about it to you and sort of pulling that story together. So yeah, it's sort of like an internal editor.
Along what axes did you need to push people the most as you were helping people?
You know, I think when you're in the weeds of something, it's really hard to remember what's interesting because you're so deep in it. You're like, I don't even, you know, if you like say a word a lot, you're like, what does that even mean anymore? And I think this is a lesson from fiction writing, actually, where it's hard to keep in mind what you as the author know, which is how the whole story unfolds versus what your reader knows, which is nothing. So when you're sort of teasing a plot line or doing some foreshadowing, it's you have to remember like, wait, how much does my reader really know about this? Is this information sort of annoying and it's like too much bang over the head? Or is it just the right amount that feels like a little teaser? So I think that's the thing people need most help with is just like remembering what somebody else knows. And hopefully we'll talk more about sort of like good editing strategies, especially from The New Yorker. But one of Harold Ross's thoughts on profiles was he was like, I don't want to go for biographical completeness. I'm much more interested in like humor or intrigue. I will sacrifice like the full scope of what this person has done just to write a more interesting piece. And I think that's actually a lesson for a lot of good writing is like, we don't need to know everything. Yeah. We just need to know the best bits, like get straight to the edge if you can. And that's really hard to do when you're an expert, especially if you're a practitioner. You're like, I don't want to leave this part out. It's like so core to the thing. It's just like, not memorable.
I think that the cardinal mistake that rite of passage students make is trying to write about too much. They just try to torch the earth. And I'm like, don't try to do that. Write about less. Write about less. Write about less. Write about less. The narrower your scope, the easier it is to write about that thing.
It's true. I mean, so much of great writing and great anything is just about obsession.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in your zone of obsession, everything looks interesting. You're like, I love it. I love it. And can you believe it? This person was married to this person who was the same as this. And they went to school with so-and-so. And you're like, what is the point? Like, give me what I need to know. And it's really hard to remember what your audience is going to be interested in versus what you as someone who's obsessed with the whole world of it is obsessed with.
And also sometimes the most things are revealed through the littlest bits. Like, say that you wanted to write something about hotels. I think you could do an amazing, exquisite piece about the experience of from looking at where the check-in line is to when they give you the card.
Yes.
And how do they greet you? What does the hotel key card feel like? What does it look like? How do they ask for your credit card? Do you have to wait in line? What are the bellmen wearing or the people behind the desk? Yeah. What are they wearing? And there's so much that's just off the top of my head. You could probably say more about the hotel industry just through that little prism than trying to say, I visited, 100 different hotels and I'm going to write the full experience about all these. It's just way too much.
I'm so glad you brought this like specific thing up because recently I've been digging into Marriott culture. And one thing I learned about their culture is that they're obsessed with the first 10 minutes. And it's kind of like their equivalent of Facebook's like 7 friends in 10 days kind of thing. They're like, okay, we have 10 minutes to get this person. They need to be like greeted by their name. They need to be like acknowledged with like about their bags. They need to like know exactly where the front desk is. Like all these things are obsessed with that first 10 minutes. So you're right on the money about something.
There we go.
Yeah.
The How I Write Hotel Chain.
Yeah, the How I Write Hotel Chain. The Guide to Hotels. I thought you were going to talk about the napkins.
I really care about napkins. I've actually sourced different napkins because I like writing my to-do list on napkins. So I've sourced the perfect paper quality to write to-do lists.
That's so cute.
I like napkins because you can fold them up easily.
Very Anne Lamott.
You can't do that with Post-it notes.
You know, Anne Lamott with her, she's got these index cards. This is an anecdote I love from Bird by Bird where Anne Lamott she sort of is like absorbing her world and she keeps an index card of observations in her back pocket and she will just pull it out, put it back in. But yeah, same thing. She's like, the index card is just like the perfect size. It's the perfect stock. That's what I like. Let's dive into magazines.
How in the world has The New Yorker been able to write with so many different writers but maintain the same style?
So it's founded by this guy named Harold Ross. He is not a New Yorker. He was born in Colorado. He dropped out of school when he was 13. He actually, before the New Yorker, edited the Stars and Stripes, which is like the either the Navy's or the Army's magazine. He came to New York with this vision of the New Yorker, but he was like very much not in its core audience. And he was always sort of afraid of being thought of as like a scholar or like someone too erudite. So he sort of like yanked this into place. And he's known to be a maniacal editor, like sort of not great with words when he is speaking, sort of bumbling, like never really able to articulate what his values were, but sort of just endlessly obsessive about tone and style. He revered his artists and his creatives, which was sort of not the norm of the day. Like sort of the more businessmen were thought of as the treasurers in the other places. Harold like loved the artists. He was like so into his writers. He gave them like real space for expression. Harold's known for inventing the talk of the town section of the newspaper. And they had a meeting that was called like the weekly talk or something. And everyone would come and pitch their ideas and talk about them. And he would just go bananas on everyone. He would be like, trash this and take this out. And he was kind of just like a wild sort of unruly force in that meeting. They said it could be like very short or it could last almost the whole day. Oh, wow. And he would just hear ideas, play them through his own head's filter. And yes, no, even talking about this meter a little bit of just like, what you say yes to is sort of like what ships. And so he was really willing to just say, no, 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 hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it, love it. And I think that's how a lot of great writing happens, is just going through the machine. The great stuff we see in The New Yorker is very heavily edited. It's very heavily fact-checked. So there's just sort of it just goes through like a long cycle of editing and fixing until it's like in its final shape.
Did he have a particular passion for profiles?
He did. And he says profiles are, they're all about obsession. They're about obsession in the person that's covered. And it's also about obsession in the writer. So the writer has to be obsessed with the subject and the subject has to be obsessed with their subject. And that sort of chain of obsession sort of helps you like pick the right people to cover, pick the right anecdotes and stories to pull out. And like we were saying before, he was not interested in like biographical fidelity. He did not care about covering the whole story. He just cared about finding the most interesting bits that were illuminating. And then maybe the other thing that's interesting about how the New Yorker edits is they really prefer exclusives, which means that they have to write about sort of odd topics. And because it takes them so long to put these things out, they sort of have to be kind of sure that they're going to be the only ones talking about this thing in this way. So it sort of forces them to that edgier place. They don't want to compete.
I love profiles.
I know.
I think that they are just the perfect length. I think biographies are often too long. What I like about a profile is I can sit down and I can read it in one sitting. So my completion rate on profiles is very high. And I still remember my first college internship. It was a Thursday afternoon and I went upstairs and I sat down on one of the beanbag chairs and I read the New Yorker profile of Mark Andreessen.
Oh, and that's a great one.
I remember so vividly how inspired I got. And there's something about the length of a profile that I adore.
There's really something to this like 5,000 to 10,000 word profile. It's a classic constraints breed creativity. It's just like, okay, you're never going to tell this person's entire life story. You probably get three great anecdotes. What are they? And I think it really pushes you to find the right stuff.
How do you think these profiles are researched? Is it the same? Is it...
I'm learning a little bit about this now. I think some of them that we read has been like years in the making. The steps are really like pick your subject that has its own taste involved. Spend time with this person and like pick up on their quirks and their anecdotes. This is why like almost all profiles start with like, I met this person for lunch at the so-and-so. You're sort of like trying to be in the scene with them. The third is just like, reading and background on them. And then the fourth is just getting the words right to express that thing. And all of those have like deep processes behind them and a lot of rigor. And I think it's just like the alchemy of getting all those things right. It's tough.
What are some of the things you've learned about Vanity Fair?
Oh man, I love Vanity Fair so much. Okay, I think my favorite thing about Vanity Fair is sort of Tina Brown introduced in the mid 80s when she took over as editor. And she was coming from like a British gossip magazine called Tatler, which for some reason like sounds very British to me. And she introduced this concept of high-low, which is, I think the way she describes it is like, we want like a little bit of Britney Spears and like we want more about public relations in like Ghana or something, but we need like a little bit of Britney Spears too. And in doing so, you sort of elevate the lowbrow stuff and you sort of bring within reach the highbrow stuff. And she's the master at sort of introducing those intermittently so that the magazine is sort of full of surprises and attitude and taste. It's not heavy. So I think about this all the time, this high-low. Like, I think about how amazing chefs just love junk food. And it's just like, yeah, these snacks are like perfectly engineered to like make my taste buds go bam.
Go berserk.
Yeah. And chefs just love junk food. It's so funny. It's like when they're done with their shift, like cooking for these Michelin star restaurants, they like want a bag of chips. It's amazing. So I think highbrow or high-low has these qualities too, where like we like get to like sort of titillate our aspirational qualities, but we're also sort of like anchored by the small sort of maybe like trashier stuff that actually is like somewhat juicy and salacious too.
So what's the takeaway here, that a brand should run between high and low, or that brand should either be lowbrow or highbrow, or that even the most highbrow people can learn from lowbrow culture? What should I be taking away from this?
As with all cultural things, like it's hard to copy someone else's. Like the most brand thing is to just be maximally you. But I think the takeaway is that the uncanny valley between highbrow and lowbrow is like very wide. And that's actually like, that's the worst place to be. And I think this is a lesson for a lot of things. And we talked about this already. It's just like pulling to the extreme is actually like way more interesting. And actually the idea that I've been thinking a lot about this, like we may be in like the end of earnestness phase. And I think sometimes we just like need a break from like heavy stuff or big feature launches. Like I love when brands are like funny.
Okay.
That's hard to do. And I think it seems like unserious or something. But like, we're all people. We like to laugh. We like to like have a joke. Like the New Yorker cartoons, an iconic part of that magazine. And just like a little break from like, you know, we got pages and pages and like the New Yorker is dense. Like the text is small. And just like, oh, now I get this like cute little break. Fun.
Well, this is what is truly exceptional to be about. To me, about the New Yorker, is that they took all these writers, Gladwell and all these other people, and they somehow retained a distinct voice that always hits.
Yes.
It's magical to me.
This was actually true in the beginning, too. Harold Ross says this a lot. It was like all about being a talent magnet for the right people. So actually, by upholding this like very sort of weird and specific set of standards, the people who wanted to write like that came to him. So I think when Malcolm Gladwell, I don't know him, I don't know his process, maybe he will come on this podcast at some point, but my guess is when he's writing something for the New Yorker, he's like, I'm writing something for the New Yorker. Like his spine goes like a little straighter than if he was just going to publish something to his Substack. I don't think he has a Substack, but you get the point. Like it's aspirational.
What else should I know about Vanity Fair? I haven't really read Vanity Fair.
What else should you know about Vanity Fair? Okay. And this is true of the New Yorker too. Obsessed with the packaging around the whole thing. This is why I love magazines. They say text, visuals, attitude. It's like all of it at the same time. Tina Brown from Vanity Fair has this thing like you should be able to throw the magazine on the floor and it opens to a random page and you know which one. You know what magazine we're in. Tina was obsessed with the covers. Like, do you recall maybe Demi Moore on the cover, like sort of naked and pregnant? She like fully curated this whole thing and it just made a huge splash. She was like obsessed with what the cover looked like. Harold from New Yorker, he says himself that he got the look right before he got the content right. Mm. And this is definitely something that I learned from Figma and sort of brought to the Kool-Aid Factory, which is like my first big writing project online, was that actually the packaging of it really matters. Like it helps you arrive at the content in a certain way. This beautiful sign.
Right logo. I spent a long time on that.
Yeah, I think it matters. I think it's how you, and you know, great writers set the scene. And I think, or like we eat with our eyes. There's like a lot of precedence for this kind of thing. I think giving that sort of design, love, and attention helps a reader arrive at your writing in a certain mood or mindset. And no shade on Substack. I think it's doing an amazing thing for the internet. But I kind of lament that they all look the same. I'm like, what is the wrapper around this thing? Like outside of just the words themselves, which it's nice to have some sort of purity. Just like, how should I like, I don't know, how should I feel when I show up here? Certainly different if I'm reading like a theology Substack versus, a funny one versus a profile versus something else. I want the look.
One of the things that I find is sometimes in the editing process, I can reduce my personality in the name of perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really been trying to counter that instinct.
I think this is Chris Sacco who said this. I don't know. But I think it's like, be your authentically weird self. Like, that's why your friends love you. Like, that's why your reader will love you. It's just like, because you're kind of weird. So I try to like pull those out if I can remember.
Yeah. And having a compass towards that weirdness, like you're talking about the New Yorker profiles, they want to do something in a way that hasn't been done before. You want to write things in a way that's like, where is that coming from? And even a lot of what we admire about other people is like these funny catchphrases that almost are like, huh, where'd you come up with that?
Yeah, totally. Because it has, I mean, there's just, we're inundated with so much volume of everything. Like, what will cut across? What is inertia not doing? Like, that's what's memorable. That's what's interesting. And that's the thing that's so hard to write, because it seems weird and it looks weird. And you're like, I like this. Is anyone else going to like it? I don't really know. It's sort of off in some way. But I try to, yeah, what we were saying before about turning the dial up on like the inner voice. Like, to me, writing is very much just like a practice in listening to myself and like trying to put the microphone close to things that I think like should get more attention. And we were talking about this last night, that in periods where I am low belief in myself, I don't want to write, because I don't like trust that inner voice as much. It doesn't seem as believable or reliable or as interesting to me. And I think that's a sign that, yeah, it goes both ways. Like, when I'm not feeling myself, I don't want to write because I don't want to listen to the inner voice. And it's sort of like a cycle. But I do think there's something there about like trying to like do those self scans and understand like what is going on in here.
Yeah, the analogy that's coming to mind for me is, you know, when you're at the doctor's office and they take that thing and they like make it touch your chest or something. And the doctor's like, I'm going to listen to you breathe now. And I'm like, what? And I've never used one of those, so who knows if it even works. But then they're like, okay, everything sounds good. Now take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. But that's sort of, you're talking about putting the microphone to your inner voice. Yeah. That's the analogy that's coming.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's just like my like insides are making some noise and I just need to hear what they're saying. Yeah, there's probably a bad interpretation of that too. But you know what's funny? My my partner is a neuroscientist, and he does computational neuroscience. And analogy that he uses is like, imagine all of our neurons are in like a loud, noisy stadium. And what we used to be able to do in recording, so like reading out from neurons, is we would like hold the microphone above the stadium. So we would sort of get like the collective sound of like what all the neurons are making. And slowly with advances in technology, we can actually bring the microphone down to like individual people and hear the individual conversations. And I think that's what I'm like, that is a version of what I'm saying when holding the microphone to my like inner voice, which is like, okay, I'm feeling like anxious, or like when someone's talking to me about like leaning out of work, I'm feeling grumpy. Like, what's going on in there? Like, I want to know, I want to unpack it. So I'm just like slowly lowering the mic so I can get to like the real stuff.
What have you found in your editing process for things that work? You talk about redlining and other things like that.
Yeah. Editing.
Why do you say editing?
Because I remember my high school lit teacher was like, great writers edit 8 times more than they write. And I was like, those people sound very inefficient to me. I was, and they don't sound like very good writers. That was like how that landed on me. I was like, I don't think those people are very good. And then I used to also have this like meme in my head of the percentage of things that were in first draft to final draft. Like, I wanted that to be as high as possible. And now I'm like at 0%, like first draft to last draft most of the time. So the editing process is like really, it's the whole thing for me. And I would say the parts of the editing process that like might be interesting to others is, one, just like an enthusiasm for editing. Like, I'm just like, yes, I want to be edited. I want to be resonant. And in order to be resonant, I need to like bounce this off many other people. So my editing process is very much in person versus like getting comments in a doc. Another thing I do in my editing process is I have a doc called Darlings. And it's because sometimes I fall in love with a paragraph or the way I said something, but it just no longer has a place. And I don't want to kill them. So I put them in the Darlings doc. And like every now and then I'll go and read it. And that's sort of like some kind of pump up mechanism. But I like having a place for cut stuff to go. Another thing I do in editing is I will read the writing into a recorder, and then I will play it back to myself. And this is part of like, that doesn't sound like you. Something about saying it with words instead of just reading it on the page and like translating into my head is really helpful.
Wait, hold on. So you read it out loud.
Yeah, I record myself.
And then you listen to it back.
Yeah.
And you feel like you get different things from the reciting versus the listening?
Yeah, both. I'm just like, this feels weird coming out of my mouth, or this feels weird hearing it doesn't sound like you. And I think my style is awfully lyrical. So it's sort of, that helps, just hearing how it sounds. Or like, if I'm getting like stuck saying it, I'm like, there's probably something wrong with the text. You do that too, don't you? A version of it? You like say it out loud or something? Or
yeah, towards the end, I'll sometimes do that. In the final draft, just talking out loud, you do get a lot from it. But I've never spoken and recorded it and then listened to it. I want to try doing that.
It's a little crazy, but it works for me. It helps me stay in the authentic place. An experience I had growing up as an athlete is like always watching tape. So you like playing a game and then your coach sits you down and you have to like watch yourself be like too slow to the ball, or like not shooting on time, or like making the wrong decision. You are just constantly watching yourself at work. When I worked in sales, we would like record ourselves doing the pitch and like meticulously critique. I think I have a real comfort with that, like a real comfort with like being coached, being critiqued. And I think there's something about finding a way to watch tape of yourself, whether that's in meetings or just like reading your own text, that's like in the critique taste self-editing zone, that's like worth trying to cultivate. So I think that's like part of the enthusiasm of being edited, is just like getting comfortable being critiqued. I have a musician friend who's the same way. He's just been like, just like reps, coach, like yell, doesn't sound right, do it again. And like having that, the energy to do those reps and to like elevate the thing is, yeah, that's only going to come from inside you. But I think you can like get practiced at that thing.
How much of it do you think is watching game film versus the coaching?
I think the combo is helpful. Like someone who knows what great looks like, and that person can be you, is just like, it's so hard to see the right pass in the middle of the soccer game. Mm-hmm. But when you watch it on tape, you're like, they were wide open. I can't believe I missed them.
Uh-huh.
And then next time you're like, yeah, the head on the swivel. That's the soccer word. You're just like, keep your head on the swivel. And you're just like, I'm so crushed. I like missed the game winning pass. Like you really pay for it. And then when you see it from bird's eye view, you like, so yeah, that's like inherently obvious, but like having the coach there to like help remind you, let's watch tape. This is what good looks like. Did you miss, you know? So I think some mentorship in that regard is helpful. Another thing that this isn't like quite editing, but in periods when I'm writing a lot, I'm also reading a lot. Like there's something about the loop of like taking good words in and like also producing them. And I heard you mention this on another podcast with someone, that you have someone in your life that memorizes scripture and you feel like he has like a deeper.
I do. Memorize a ton of scripture.
Yeah. So I also like, I have like paragraphs that sort of live in my head that I just like, I've read them 1,000 times because I just like love how they sound. And I think this is like all part of the process, like of the poetry of it. I want to hear it. I want it to be sing-songy. I want it to like be music.
Yes, I have a note in my Evernote that is just my favorite paragraphs.
Yeah.
And then what I'll do if I'm feeling, there's something off with this, I'll just go back in there and I'll say, okay, what's going on here? What do I like about the vibe of these ones that I'm not getting? And the thing is, I think that there's certain emotions that I find it hard to capture in writing that are totally part of me. And I think that there's a sort of a sweetness and a melancholy that I can get when I'm just talking to somebody or out and about. Whereas like writing really activates the like logical, factual, but there's just certain things that I'm like, I sort of have to work for certain parts of my personality in writing.
Same thing for me happens when I translate from my brain into my hand. Is it like, it comes out kind of like in a teacher voice or something, where I'm like trying to be like, I don't know, be like really explicative or something, or like I'm really trying to explain. It's annoying. And I have to sort of pull it back.
Teacher voice is such a thing. People all of a sudden start talking like this.
I know. I'm just like, why?
But people do the same thing with writing.
I know.
All the time.
I know.
I have so many friends who are brilliant when they're speaking. They're good orators. And they'll be like, nice, you should turn that into a piece of writing. And then when they send me back, I'm like, this is how you write? And it's timid and it's fearful and there's no humanity behind it. I'm like, you're not being a human being. You are being you're giving me an assemblage of facts and figures.
Yep.
And that's not what I want.
Maybe this is like another good editing tip. And this comes from a straight practice too. I really try to imagine a person reading it that I want to. Not like people, not like a B2B marketer at such and such, like a specific person. like with a face. So that's like another part of editing that I think helps with this human thing. Like if I was across the table from Stuart Brand, for some reason, he is one I think of a lot. If I'm across the table from Stuart Brand, like, am I going to get that twinkle in the eye or is he going to be snooze?
What's good about Stuart Brand as a person to write for?
I think he's smart and he's funky.
Funky. That's a great word.
Yeah, he's
that's
funky.
A great word.
He's a cool guy. And he's seen a lot of ideas. He's like, he's high low, I think.
You know what's underrated?
What?
Why'd you do that? Because I like it.
Yeah.
Super underrated.
Totally.
Because I like it. Because if you don't trust that, you end up with this regression to the mean.
Yes. George Saunders says, like, the mark of good writing is someone wants to read the next sentence. It's just like, yeah, what's going to make me lean in? Like, because you like it. Because you want to. That's the only way.
And that funkiness. Because it is the antidote to that homogeneity that is so common. And, you know, you talk about reading a lot. I think that you need to be careful about the influences that you're pulling from and moving towards funkiness or just things that certain writers do that you want to emulate and bring into your own work. The hard part then is how to do that in a way that's real and authentic and not some sort of fabrication of other people's writing. I was reading something the other day and somebody had tried to do a joke and it was not funny. And I said, that joke's not funny. And she was like, but I'm trying to pull from here. And I was like, but look, it doesn't feel like you. And it's sort of like early on when you're trying something, like I learned this when I was playing tennis. You sort of start and you're trying to emulate what's right, but you still look ridiculous. And over time, people who are very good at tennis, they look very natural as they're doing it. And the same thing happens in writing. You're kind of like trying to emulate that thing or this thing, and it's just not landing. And over time, there's a fluidity that emerges.
It's true. We were talking this morning about how writing is not really about like the words itself. Like that's not what I land on. It's just like, how do you tap into like the place or the vibe? So I think reading things with like the vibe you like can like help yank you. But I think, yeah, there's something to just like copy pasting stuff that is just never gonna stick.
Yeah. You want to hear something funny? One of my biggest inspirations for writing that I've seen recently was I went to stay with some friends and they live in Opelika, Alabama.
Okay.
And I went to stay with them and the wife of my friend, she said, hey, you're coming in. And she like takes pride in being a tremendous hostess. And she sent me the most well-written, warm, caring, what do you call it? A questionnaire about my preferences. How do you like the pillows on your bed?
That's
hard,
so
soft? How many do you like? What sort of drinks do you like? Are you this was the best. When you wake up in the morning, are you like a, woo, let's get up? Are you like, don't talk to me for 3 hours?
Great kind question.
Of person? And the vibe of the way it was written, I felt like she was sitting right next to me.
Aww.
And she was laughing at the top of her lungs.
Aww.
And it that vibe just like swept through the questionnaire. And I was like, far inspiration. That is such a well-written questionnaire.
That's so sweet. And there's like a real lesson in there about caring about your reader or like your audience. And this is like kind of to the similar point of like having a single person that you're writing for. Something I like bemoan about a flavor of writing, and I think there's like maybe more of it today, is just like this like kind of view from nowhere. And I think it became pretty cool to be like, I'm writing for an audience of one, me. And I think that's actually like a noble place to start, is just like, yeah, what sounds good to me? What do I like? And then I think like the next level of writing is just like, what is in here for my reader? Like, what question am I answering for them? Like, what am I helping them see that nobody else can help them see, but just like a real care for the person who's on the other end of the page? Like, what I'm reacting to in that story of your friend is like, she was so aware of you.
Mm.
Like, you were inside that story with her. There was no note unless you were reading it. It'd be purposeless. So I think that like relationship between writer and reader, you just like cannot forget it.
Tell me about this view from nowhere. You're writing to an abstract audience.
Yes,
what you're
exactly.
Saying?
To no one in particular. It's just like might be interesting to someone.
Why do you think that became common?
I feel like I'm ripping on Substack, and I don't mean to, but I think it's a little bit of this. Just like I write for an N of one. It's just like my brain to this page to hit publish. Like there's no editing process required. Yeah, I think there's like something in that filter process between like ideas and audience that like it's pretty easy not to think about, like on Twitter. I'm just like, tweet to all followers and like all feed. I mean, this is the marketer in me of just like, who is this for? And like, what will they get from this? There's like something to hold there that we've lost a little bit.
You know what validates this is how many great books going back 100, 200, 300 years are just letters from one person to another. Like Rilke wrote That's letters great. To a young poet. And they're beautiful.
Yeah. That Wallace Stegner book.
Angle of Repose.
I haven't heard of it.
Oh, man. Same thing. It's based on letters.
They're so nice.
Yeah, they're so nice.
They're so intimate.
Yeah, they're so intimate. Yeah, they're just, we keep saying this, like slice of life, the small things, like the real inner parts. I think it's like pretty easy to do teacher voice if you're like, I'm speaking to an auditorium of people. There's so much distance between reader and writer. I'm just like, I think the act of pulling them together is you just like have to imagine someone who's real. Not like someone on the other side of their computer faceless, but like a real person. And I will say, this is like a beautiful thing about writing on the internet is like the people that come to you after into your inbox. And that's all done privately. I guess Substack did just release DMs, which I saw someone cheekily was like, Substack's got a dating network now. But yeah, like I've met amazing people in Twitter DMs or something in response to pieces, like cultivating that like deeper relationship between reader. I think you have to like hold them while you write.
We're going to cue some trumpets.
Iconic idea here.
We have to talk about your taste piece.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is the section of the show. Out of all the things you've written, this is my favorite. And I think we can spend some time here talking about taste. How you wrote it is where I want to start. Because you wrote this out of a lot of conversations with people, right?
I did. Yeah. I was like, what was like the seedling that was like, you really need to spring on this now? And to set the stage at the time, I was like, yeah, doing a lot of company consulting. And I was having a meal with a CEO of a company. And he said that he has taste in his hiring criteria. And I was like, amazing. What a cool thing. The way he arrived at getting taste in the hiring criteria is he had a recent experience where somebody executed perfectly on the spec and like still somehow got to the wrong implementation. And I think it was like about implementing some kind of like candidate tracking software or something. It was just like, I feel like it was like the wrong choice. There was like, it hit all the things, but there was like no taste. It was like no real understanding of the experience. So we like put it in our hiring criteria. Like we want taste now. And I was like, yes, amazing. We love taste. Like surely if we're going to hire on it, you've like defined it. And he was like, not really. It's like one of those, like we got rid of like culture fit because we're like, what is it? And then I was like, oh my God, I think taste is the new one. We're like, I want taste here and taste there. And this person's got to have good taste. But no one knew what it meant. So I was like, okay, I became obsessed with it. And I was just like, and I think it was like a pretty fun dinner party topic because everyone's got a thought and ideas. And it was like pretty fun to watch people work through it because it's such a ubiquitous term now. I feel like people are just throwing it around. They're like, wait a second, what do I mean? So anyway, it was just like, it was sort of a fun collective curation kind of thing.
And talking about the piece, because the structure is very specific too, that it's basically numbered to say, here's like 28 different things that I believe about taste.
Yes. So if this format is just stolen with pride from Susan Sontag. She has a famous essay called Notes on Camp. And it's the exact same format where she's like, this is a slippery term. I don't really know what it means. If I try to force it into the structure of some like narrative that makes sense, I won't be able to do it. So here's just like some thoughts on this term. So I copied that format for the taste piece because I think it had the same quality. It was like so slippery, the phrase. I didn't want to flatten it, but I didn't want to miss the whole point, which was to like give us a way to think and talk about what it is. So yeah, this was, I'll credit my friend Molly Miko with this idea. She was like, we've got to write it like Notes on Camp. And then the editor that I was working with at Arena, whose blog we published it on, she was incredible. She was just like, I mean, I probably started out with like 50 and she was like, girl, we got to get to the good stuff. So she was just sort of like a relentless curator with me and like picking like, what are the great ideas? And something that was actually freeing about the format is because they were numbered, it was pretty easy to pull out like, this is not the core thing. This is not the core thing.
How do you go about cultivating your taste?
Fran Lebowitz has this concept that I think is really awesome, which is that the reason theater was so good in the 70s was that the audience had high expectations. And she calls this connoisseurship. She was like, the people coming, they needed something good. So like all the artists had to deliver. And I think I'm like a good like critic or watcher or reader, like how you are with the Stripe Press books. You're like, I notice the paper and I notice the lay flat. Like I appreciate it. So like when people do it, I like love it. So I think I'm a good consumer. Like when I watch TV, I like want to talk about the episode with everybody and like what I saw and noticed and the allegory and the colors. And so I think I'm a good, or I try to be a good consumer, like really think about what I'm ingesting.
One of the things that I think is very important in training your taste is recognizing what you love and what you hate.
Yes.
And being okay with what you love and what you hate being different, decorrelated with what you are supposed to love and hate.
Very much so. This is like, I guess this is going to be the meme of the whole thing, is just listening to what's going on inside you. But this is in the taste piece too, but this idea comes from George Saunders, where just like putting like a positive or negative meter on like everything and just being like, I like this, I don't like this, I like this, I don't like this, and just like continuing to just watch how you like and how you feel, and just picking a few lanes to do that in. I think it's just too exhausting to have that for everything. And I think it would make you like quite annoying. So I think just like picking the things that you're like, it's going to be fashion or it's like going to be coffee. I definitely have one for coffee, and I like have a scale and I measure the beans and I like grind them to the perfect amount. If I did that for everything, I would be a monster.
Susan Sontag says that taste is very domain specific. It's sort of like vertical in lanes. Is that something that you agree with, or do you think that there is global taste that can be increased?
I think the knowledge of like what comes with trying to improve your taste, which is sort of more observant, more appreciative, listening to your insides more, like noticing this reality has a surprising amount of detail. I think the insight that like cultivating taste brings to you is that sort of has knock-on effects where you're like, wow, like somebody chose this rug and those curtains and those books, like this paper for the menu, even if it wasn't tastefully done, like that unlock, like, wow, everything is like a choice that somebody made somewhere. That is something beautiful to know about the world. Like that person chose to put that on, even if it's not the most tasteful thing. So I do think it has some knock-on effects. I think of it as a virtue for that reason. It like helps you appreciate more and see the world differently.
Yeah. Why did you use the word appreciator?
Because there's a set of things that I don't have great taste in. Fashion is one of them. And I love when I see someone that does. I'm just like, wow, I know the delta between like me and that. And like, thanks.
Tell me about some of the similarities between taste and cultivating it, and then the writing and the editing process.
I think editing, especially editing yourself, is sort of the same as the process of cultivating taste, because you're doing that, to go back to Saunders' PN, positive negative meter again, you're sort of looking at the stuff you've already done and assigning that like PN to it. It's sort of the same process, is just like, yes, this is doing it for me. No, it's not. And that's the same process of like cultivating taste. Like, yes, I like that outfit. No, I don't. Yes, I like this coffee. No, I don't. And why? How do I like get it to the place of yes? So I think editing is about sort of like evaluating things at face value and like deciding how you're going to move them into like the better place, which is kind of the same as the taste thing, where you're like, okay, I don't quite like this, or I don't like this top with these pants. Like, how do I move it to the better place? And it's that same like, okay, no, I don't like it. I'm trying to understand why. Then I can improve it.
I love what you said about and why. I think that's the core thing. Yeah, it's not enough to just be like, yes, no, but to somehow over time, it does take a while to put words to your emotional landscape and say, what are the things that I like? What do they have going? And
I think you said something in there that I really liked that was like either articulating or explaining your like emotional landscape. It's so hard, and it's really worthwhile, because that's how you sort of turn the dials of your life to like get yourself surrounded by beautiful things or make more beautiful things. So I really like that. Yeah, I'm thinking of The New Yorker again, because Harold was so bad at articulating this. Like, there was just like no style guide. There was only the writer's room and him being like, yuck, like dislike it, do more this, do more that. And I do think there's, like you said, it takes a lot of time. You have to just put a lot through the machine to see. And then I think the style guide comes out. It's sort of like it's emergent. But if you try to like pin it to terms too early, you can lose some of the magic. So like a lot of times it's just like, it's not right, but like, I don't know. I'm going to like search for the words, but like, and I want to find them, but just like, it feels off. And I think there's a temptation, especially in management or in collaboration, where you want to like quiet down that it feels off thing because you can't explain it. And you're like, I don't know, it's just a spidey sense. But like, that's going to make me sound ridiculous in this meeting if I'm like, I don't think we should hire this person because my spidey sense. That's like completely inappropriate. So we like, a lot of times we'll turn that part of our like, that little quiet, like, me, 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 something's not working. We like turn it off at work because we're like, I don't know, I can't explain it. But I think it's like important to try to like start listening to it. And like you said, trying to put language around it.
Yeah. You made me think of a good writing prompt when you use the word emergent. And one thing to ask yourself is, okay, I've spent some time in this area of the world, in my work, in a project. What are some of the words and phrases that I've developed over the course of experience that I only saw by really zooming into reality? And now let me write about that.
Yep. And I think this is a great part about having writing as a practice in my life. Like, I write a lot that I will never publish, I don't even think of publishing. It's just to like understand myself. And occasionally these like meme things or like a thread I want to pull comes out. But I think it's just a great practice to sort of, yeah, put words around what's going on.
What are some of the strange places that you've looked to cultivate taste for your own writing or to maybe even pull inspiration? For example, I think Captain Underpants is genius, absolutely genius. You pick it up, you look at it, it's funny, it's playful. It's like got a good mix of like words and images and even just the name Captain Underpants is hilarious, right? You get this whole image in your head and kids just sort of fly through it. I'm like, hey, what's going on there? All this to say, I think it's really easy to be like, well, I write about this thing, so I'm going to, you know, take inspiration from these people, these other highbrow people. Like, how about like the most lowbrow stuff all over the place that then you can pull in because it's very human and relatable?
Yes, yes, yes. That's a great example. I definitely like appreciate more children's or like YA text than I would expect along these lines. I'm like, there's something like so simple about it that I really like. Maybe this is like less on the topic, but something I'm terrible with is like naming in general. I think I'm like really good with the long version of the idea. I'm like pretty bad at like the name of it or like the meme phrase for it. And weirdly, I think sometimes science like gets us like really right. So I try to like, lately I've been reading a lot about NASA and like amazing naming. Like all the missions have great names. All like the robots have great names. They're like so aspirational. So anyway, that's like been an example of something I'm like, okay, I think we have something to learn from science. Oh, this was another one I came across recently. The American Heart Association's periodical is called The Circulation. Isn't that so good?
That is really good.
I was like, they're clever.
That is really good.
Clever is another word I aspire to in writing. And I think The New Yorker does a great job.
Clever is one of those things that is really nice to be a little bit clever and so annoying when somebody tries to be too clever.
The best pieces for me come from trying to like say something true about my experience, or I'm trying to understand something about what's going on. So I'm trying to get to it, some kind of truth there too. And I think I just have to like keep banging until I feel like that's right. I tried having a Substack where I published regularly to it for a while. It just did not work for me because I couldn't give it that time, and then I wasn't proud of what I produced. So I think it's just being willing to put a lot of time into things, like enthusiasm about being edited. Just like, I want people's feedback. I cannot publish anything without it. I like want everyone to help me make it better. And then some of these like little tricks around recording to myself or whatever. Like I want it to feel true. And because my bar is just honest or like true, I cannot stop. I mean, it's completely all consuming. Like when I'm writing a piece, I don't run with headphones because the thoughts are so active.
Really?
Yeah. I'm just like constantly reciting and reciting, not that word, not that word. So there's a mania involved, I think. Other people are such a big part of my writing process. I think something I've learned over the years is sort of who to go to. You need an editor that's on your side. You need like sort of the yes and, which a good writer will intuit as like no to all this other stuff. And something I've noticed in editors is there's like the critics and the curmudgeons. The curmudgeons hate everything. Everything is trash. Everything is garbage. Everything must go. Nothing is good enough for their discerning eye. And that is exhausting. And it is also a fool's errand. And I think we've all had like managers like that, or like colleagues like that, or even like maybe like parents like that, where it's just like, it's not good enough. Curmudgeon. We don't need them in the editing process. What we do need is critics, people who are great appreciators. They want to find the interesting thing. Like the whole goal is like what gets the spark lit up. And all they want to do is like pull that out the most. That's who I like. I don't want the curmudgeons. It's too exhausting. But the critics, we love them. Leaned in.
I feel like there's a Steve Jobs thing here. I don't know what it is, but I think a lot of people look at who Steve was and then they say, I'm not going to think anything is good enough. I have the highest standards in the world. Nothing will ever meet my bar. But you keep using the word appreciator, and Steve was an incredible appreciator. He had a real passion and a real heart for great art, for great design, for things of craft and excellence. And when he saw it, he was able to say, that's good.
Yes. Yeah, I think like the thing with their curmudgeons is it's never good enough, actually. There's no examples of it being great. And I think Harold Ross had this quality too. He was excitable. It's like when he saw the right thing, it was like, yeah, like we got it. And that is like, so pulling towards that place of the like, we have title, like, yes, I love it. Like there has to be that phase of the critic process, or else it's no fun. I think Elon probably has some of this quality too. It's just like, this is hard. Like, I'm going to say no a lot, but when we get it, we get it. And like, that is a celebration. So I think you sort of like need both parts of that process.
I want to talk about cultures of excellence, because when you first found Stripe, you wrote, I could immediately tell that Stripe was different.
Yeah.
What stood out to you then? And how has that culture of excellence shown up in your writing?
I think in order to get that kind of culture, you have to fund it quite literally. Like you have to say, okay, actually the entire like marketing and product team is going to spend a whole extra week on the launch blog post. And that's like a week of time they're like not building. So you have to actively fund that kind of care. Like you have to be willing for your people to spend time on it. And I think a lot of people want the outcomes of the polished stuff, but they won't fund it. And I'm working on a project now that's sort of a big swing at something. And it's like, okay, this swing requires like, you got to hire a whole other person. And we got to like, maybe even two people. And we're going to have to like take time away from the existing team to do this. And that means like this stuff that's like also a priority, like falls off this month. What do you think? And you have to say yes to it if you want the big thing. So I think a lot of people want to skip funding the hard work. Or like Steve Jobs, another great example. Like he funds the time to like do the last 1%. And like we know this law, like 80% of the work is in the last. Yeah. And so you either fund that part of the work or you don't. It can never be the best version unless you fund it. And it's like really hard to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And like maybe some like advice to early writers or early people that like want to see their best work is just to find a place where the last 20% is funded. Like find a boss that will do that for you, or like give yourself all of Sunday to write something. But like you have to find a place to fund the last 20%, or else you're never going to get it. I wonder like if this is your experience writing some of your great pieces, they like take a while. Yeah, I've been thinking about like this Steve stuff a lot now that we have the headset. And every time a new Apple thing comes out, you wonder is this what Steve would have produced? Or like sometimes when I see the laptops with like all the different charger things, I'm like, would Steve have allowed this? And there's probably some great technical reason why we need all the different charger holes, or the strap needs to be big, or whatever it is. I wonder if someone funded continuing to push on these edges, if we would have gotten something different.
How has the fiction writing that you've done seeped into your nonfiction?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to beat a little of this out of myself now. I said this before, I have a more lyrical style that I think is well-suited for fiction and some narrative nonfiction. I think I can be a little verbose in my business writing. That said, I think the most important thing I learned from the fiction writing is two things. Like one, I much prefer writing nonfiction. I've always felt kind of weird in my fiction era because I was like living with all these like fake characters in this fake world. And I just felt odd. I like being like in the world and like learning about real things. Not that fiction can't do that. And then the second piece is we talked a little bit about kind of holding our audience. You have to be very cognizant of how you're moving and in control of how you're moving your reader through the story. So I think that piece has stuck with me.
The thing that I would posit is that there's a lot of life in your writing. Mm. And I wonder how much of that comes from fiction.
Yeah, I think so. Like world building and building up characters. Like I'm interested in that piece of writing. You know what also writing my novels taught me is that I could do a big thing all by myself.
Sure.
A lot of our work is just collaborative and you never really know what your individual contribution is. It's just, it's hard to map with, like, I wrote every word in that book.
Right. And I like
spent all my days and all my nights thinking and developing that story. And I like what's in there is like really mine. There's of course help along the way, but that was my first big project that I did by myself.
One of my favorite Brieisms is, I want to get it right.
Okay.
Not even a simple message can survive a game of telephone.
Oh my God. Speaking of things that I pored over for way too long, this, maybe you recognize it. This is from the application to Tyler's Emergent Ventures program. So the question is, what is a consensus view that you agree with? Which is weirdly harder than feeling contrarian. So this was my answer. Not even a simple message can survive a game of telephone. And it's true. I have a much, much younger sister. So we used to play telephone with her a lot. And I mean, it is truly funny that even a simple phrase and even without like a five-year-old involved, it's really hard.
And that applies to writing because you have to write things down so that writing keeps things stable, steady, and concrete or something.
Yeah, it codifies the idea. The other thing I think about writing is just trying to produce a lot. I've been talking a lot about how I like pour over everything and edit a ton. And I'm trying to channel a little bit more of this energy that just like producing a lot actually helps you get to the best stuff. Probably means you have to throw a lot out too. But Seinfeld again has this quote in the same interview where he says, it's just a matter of tonnage. Like you're just like producing a lot, saying no to a lot, but the stuff that's left is great.
Yep.
And then sort of like another thing in conflict of this that I've been thinking a lot about is my colleague, Patrick O'Shaughnessy is always like, if it works fast. And just like, if it's flowing, it's flowing. Like, get it out. I think Morgan Housel said this on the podcast too. It's just like, he knows when it's flowing. And then he just like lets it rip and move on. But I think I resonate more with the sort of comedian's way, just like writing a quadrillion jokes, performing them on stage, refining them, getting them right. But like there's just a sheer volume of words like that you just have to go through the sludge to find like the magic kernels.
The sludge.
I know, the sludge. I like David and I were walking last night and a friend who's working on a piece texts me, writing is pain. It was like at like the perfect moment. It's just like, it is pain.
It is the sludge just getting junk and junk and junk out there. And it's funny because my median second when I'm writing is, I am doing such a bad job. And then, you know, when it hits me that writing, that I've actually made progress by writing is once I've stepped away from what I've been doing and I start talking to somebody else and I realize how much depth and dimensionality I've discovered through the process. I'm like, whoa. Yeah,
I know. You're evolving as you write and your thinking is evolving. This is why I kind of think it takes a while. You got to like put it under the bed a while and come out. Like you have to revisit your own ideas a lot. You know, this is like also from that Seinfeld interview. A tip that I like is like to reward yourself after you've done the hard work.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, I like did the morning pages or I sat for 4 hours or I like nailed that intro. Like I'm going to go.
I think that what you're uniquely good at is I don't meet a lot of people who have a combination of being able to observe well like you do and have the patience to nurture a good observation and be able to write the personal component. I think that really distinguishes you. Most people I know are good at writing personal, but their observations aren't all that interesting or the opposite.
That's not. Yeah, I'm always trying to hone that. Like, I love Joan Didion. She's an amazing observer. Yeah, Tina Brown says this about Vanity Fair too. I can teach someone to write a lead, but I can't teach them what to notice. And maybe this is also what intersects with the taste thing, is just like, I want to be like an active, like metabolizer. Like when I walk down the street, I want to like see the buildings. I just like want to know what's going on here.
Noticing.
Yeah, and speaking of Steve Jobs, one of my favorite anecdotes from the new book, Make Something Wonderful, is how he would, when as a young boy, he wanted to like take apart a radio with his neighbor. Like he just wanted to see all of its guts. And I don't have that with tech. I don't have that with cars, but I like do have that with people and I do have that with ideas.
That's what the show is about.
I guess so, yeah.
Like I want to know the guts of the writing process. I want to see the ugly stuff. I want to know how something is written, how things are edited. I want to deconstruct this entire thing, and I want to make it ugly and gross. Exactly. And then through the reconstruction, like divine and beautiful.
Yes, I can. Yeah, I can deliver the ugly parts of the process.
You're like Song Exploder, but for writing.
Yes, exactly. When you're stewing on an idea, is there anything you're doing besides conversation? I'm just still caught on this. I've thought about it for 9 months.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm just like talking to myself about it constantly, reading constantly. I'm chewing on it. It's chewing on me, actually, is what's happening. Hmm. I feel physically uncomfortable.
Really?
Yes, I do. I feel physically uncomfortable until it's sorted.
How is that process different when you're trying to understand something that you've experienced, like the stripe piece, versus be a cartographer of a new landscape, like the chase piece?
I think we talked about this in when I came to Rite of Passage, but there's a quote I love that's like, there's two kinds of creativity. One is like Einstein, where you explain the world how it already is. And the other is like Walt Disney, where you are bringing new ideas into the world. I think I'm much more... I'm much more of an Einstein. I'm nothing like Einstein. But I like explaining the world how it already is. And I would put the taste thing into that category. Hmm. Like, there's almost no original thoughts in there. I'm just like trying to curate what I'm experiencing or what I'm seeing or observing. And I think even the personal essays are a little bit like that. I'm just like, what am I seeing inside me? Like, how do I describe that in a way that's true? But yeah, definitely more of the explainer. I don't think I have anything new to say, really.
Bree, I'm glad we did this.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me, David. This was really fun.
I feel like there was so much in your head, and I've read a lot of it, and I was like, this needs to be in audio form.
Oh, that's really kind. Yeah. Hopefully there's something helpful in there somewhere.
Lots of good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.